Hello, Curious to Serious listeners. This is your co-host, Emma. Today, we're excited to talk to Max Crossland Wood, who is a graduate student in developmental neuroscience and psychopathology at the Anna Freud Center at University Central London. We're jumping straight into a history on UCL's Masters of Research program, which is how Max has ended up in Yale working on a clinical ketamine study. From there, we're driving right into what insight he's gained from the clinical trial design standpoint and how his studies in psychopathology have strongly informed his appreciation for a dynamic approach to long-term psychological support for everyone. Then, we're going to close up with a fascinating model based on his academic and work experiences, which provides a probable solution for long-term transpersonal and systemic therapeutic modalities after psychedelic therapy, and who should have access to this long-term type of care. Check out the timestamps in the description below for a more detailed breakdown of today's interview. Curious to Serious is a psychedelic grads podcast where we interview students and professionals in the psychedelic space to better understand how they've navigated the path from being curious about psychedelics to wanting to dedicate their career to the psychedelics. This podcast wouldn't be here without MAPS, whose support has allowed us to keep the online psychedelic grad community platform free for all members and publish these epic conversations. Without further ado, let's jump right in.
I'm currently situated in New Haven, Connecticut. So I'm doing a year of research at Yale, as part of my two-year master's program in London. And so my first year, I did last year, and that was at the Anna Freud Center, which actually has a really interesting history, which might be worth kind of briefly discussing. So the center was originally a nursery that was set up in during the war. So Anna Freud and her father, Sigmund Freud, fled Nazi Germany and then settled in London. And Anna Freud then, set up this Hampstead War Nursery. And through observations during this time, she started developing some theories on the mental illnesses which might present in children and the kind of the development of psychopathology. And through this, she, I think it was in like the 70s, she wrote a notorious piece called Normality and Child Psychopathology. And this really kind of laid the foundations for developmental psychology. And then in, I think, 1990, the nursery changed into a academic center for psychoanalysis with a developmental lens. So it was a kind of a school for teaching, but also a clinic for children to go and to receive psychoanalytic treatment for their mental suffering. And so this kind of brings us to present day, where currently, Peter Fonagy is the chief executive of the center, and he is quite a notorious psychoanalyst for his theory on mentalization. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but he kind of developed attachment theory into this new approach, where you kind of integrate a bit of neurobiology, you're integrating cognitive psychology, you're also applying a developmental lens, and it's the idea of how our primary kind of caregiving relationships shape our brains, and it kind of incorporates the neurobiology behind attachment and how we develop this ability to reflect on our own, but also other people's thinking. And that's kind of his whole theory, is basically stating that this is the overarching factor which can result in mental suffering. So if you have an inability to accurately reflect on your thinking as well as other people's thinking, it can result in a lot of distress, and then you have all sorts of mental problems that can manifest from that. And so he's the chief executive at the moment, and he's also a tutor. So I got the pleasure of having him teach me for a few modules, which was really insightful. But yeah, so that was a little bit about the center. And my course is it's titled Developmental Neuroscience and Psychopathology, which is a bit of a fancy way of saying we're dealing with psychopathology, which is Latin for mental suffering, but we're trying to understand it from multiple perspectives. And so we want to draw from neuroscience. We want to also draw from psychoanalysis. And overarching all of that, we need to take a developmental approach to it. Developmental meaning the idea that mental suffering is a developmental process, and it's not like suddenly things occur without any correlation dictated from past experiences. And so, so broadly speaking, like, it's just multiple perspectives to understand mental suffering and how best to treat it. And I think it's a very unique course because, I don't really know many courses like it that put such an emphasis into integrating so many perspectives, particularly such polarizing perspectives like psychoanalysis and neuroscience. You know, one drawing from objectivity and being renowned as a hard science, and then the other drawing from holistic experiences and meaning and unconscious processes. And it kind of makes sense that from the 50s till now, those two perspectives have kind of been, there's been tension between the two. And when neuroscience emerged in the 70s, it was almost like it just stamped out psychoanalysis. Like, you had psychoanalysis, which dominated, you know, 40s, 50s and 60s. And then people, for whatever reason, viewed neuroscience as getting us closer to the absolute truth regarding the human condition, which has its value. And there's something very effective about taking a reductionist approach to the human experience, because, you know, you start with the experience and then you want to ask questions about what builds that experience up. And then you have to take a reductionist approach. You have to maybe operate on the neurobiological level to understand the components which build up that experience in the first place. And so it makes sense from the 70s to now that neuroscience was kind of the hot topic of understanding what's going on with human behavior and experience. But now I think we're kind of seeing a shift where psychoanalysis seems to be gaining a bit more attention. And my course is putting a lot of emphasis into trying to almost reconceptualize psychoanalysis, or whatever psychoanalysts were trying to address. I think now it's a matter of reconceptualizing it so that it's more compatible with our scientific paradigm. So it doesn't mean to say we disregard experience as being invalid, but it means that we need to have effort towards integrating those perspectives, because as soon as you start seeing a connection between the experience and the neurobiology, you know you're maybe onto something. And so one example could be the idea that the ego seems to resemble, on the neuroscientific level, the default mode network, which is a slightly simplified way of viewing things. But that's just one example where we can kind of understand the ego neuroscientifically. And so obviously, like, in the context of psychedelic therapy, we know the ego seems to dissolve when we undergo these psychedelic experiences, and we can understand that on the experiential level through phenomenology, you know, the idea of transcending, and through this experience of dying and being reborn. And that's all great in providing a rich subjective account, but then we can also explain all of that through neuroscience, just to kind of complete the picture. And so you might look into kind of ego dissociation and what that actually looks like on the neuroscientific level, in the sense of disorganizing the brain and the default mode network, increasing bottom-up processing, and these kind of primary processes that were maybe more active when you were a child or during adolescence. Going back to the course, so there's a massive emphasis on integrating these kind of objective and subjective perspectives to just get closer to the truth of what it the human condition entails. And so I was being taught for 1 year at UCL at the Anna Freud Center, and then they send us to Yale to conduct our research. So we get paired with a supervisor who our mentors believe will be a good match for us based on personality and interests. And then we go over to Yale, we get started in the lab, and we're working with a research team, and we then work towards our thesis, but alongside that we're helping out with different projects in the lab and kind of getting a feel of what it feels like to be a research assistant. And obviously my interests reside in psychedelic therapy and research, and so my mentor in London paired me with someone who was conducting a ketamine trial for suicidality in people with borderline personality disorder, which was a direct influence from previous research with treatment-resistant depression. We seem to think that ketamine has this rapid antidepressant effect and this anti-suicidal effect on people with treatment-resistant depression. And we also know that people with borderline personality disorder often comes with comorbid depression, and suicidality can be extremely high in this population due to their impulsive tendencies and also their interpersonal sensitivity, which can kind of act like a master switch. And so, the lab I'm currently working at is just seeing whether, we can take this rapid acting antidepressant and then target debilitating depressive symptoms within a population of people with borderline personality disorder. And so I've been helping out with that trial for a few months now. I've kind of just been helping with the assessment procedure. And so the way it works, it might be worth maybe me explaining a bit about the design around this treatment. Because for those who aren't aware, ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic, which at lower doses can induce psychedelic-like states. And because of the psychedelic nature of this pharmaceutical approach, we need to reconsider the design, and we need to maybe put more emphasis into the preparation and the integration when compared to conventional antidepressant designs. Such as SSRI treatment, where you get given your monthly dose by a psychiatrist and then you're chronically dosing on a daily basis for an extended period of time. This is quite different from that, where you're giving someone a drug which doesn't blunt their emotion but might increase their emotion and their experiences in the moment and maybe for a period afterwards. And so when you're giving someone a drug that increases one's experience while also dissolving one's ego, it can induce quite a vulnerable state in someone. When our ego dissolves, the walls that seem to protect us fade away, and suddenly we're vulnerable. We feel vulnerable. And due to that vulnerability, it makes it essential to have a trusting environment and a trusting team in which you can put your in which they can reassure you that you are safe when you're undergoing this potentially vulnerable and unpleasant state. And so because of that, we put a lot of emphasis into forming an alliance with the participants before they even undergo the treatment. And that's really important. So
there's a number of assessments before where you really make sure that they feel comfortable, they feel like they can put their trust in our hands. And once we feel like there's an adequate amount of trust and reassurance there, we then they then undergo the treatment. And so they get an infusion of ketamine, or either ketamine or an active placebo, midazolam, which is a 1-hour benzodiazepine. And it's a double-blind active placebo-controlled trial. So they don't know, we don't know. They don't know what they're getting, we don't know what they're getting. But they get the infusion, which lasts maybe 40 minutes to an hour. And then repeated clinical assessments for a 4-week duration. And during these assessments, we're checking up on them, making sure they're okay, seeing how they're doing, but also carrying out some interviews and self-report measures in order to decipher the effectiveness of their symptom change. And yeah, so that's something I've been just helping out with. And my thesis project is trying to utilize the data from Feinberg's lab to explore my own interests. And one thing I noticed, which was quite interesting with the placebo group, is how much their symptoms reduced. And I mean, we know already that the placebo response can be extremely powerful, but there's very limited literature on the components which generate a placebo response. You know, what are the kind of underlying therapeutic components that generate this placebo response? And in the context of this ketamine treatment design, there's two aspects which come to mind, which I think will have a lot of potential, a lot of therapeutic potential. And I think the first one is, well, the kind of going into it with all of this, doing like a novel pharmaceutical, which has been hyped by the media. So they'll no doubt be looking online before they do this trial, and they'll be seeing all these kind of headline news articles saying that ketamine, rapid acting antidepressant, a new antidepressant that's going to change the face of psychiatry, blah, blah, blah. That really instills some belief that the treatment they're going to get will be effective. And so that in itself, I'm sure, will have some kind of impact on treatment responses in this placebo group, but also the interpersonal care and attention that scaffold the participant throughout the experience. And there was one participant that I was following, and on the last assessment, I later found out she was in the placebo group. And on the later assessment, she commented on how, I should have mentioned, by week 4, she had no longer fitted the criteria for suicidality. And she was under the assumption she had received ketamine. And she was really expressing how beneficial these repeated assessments were for her. And this kind of brought me onto this line of thought of how much of the therapy lies in the interpersonal around the design. And it would be interesting, given this rapid rise in psychedelic research and and kind of accommodating for this new approach to pharmaceutical designs, where, you know, we can no longer just rely on the drug and the kind of mechanistic action of the drug. We also need to incorporate the interpersonal around it. And it's not like you need both, really, for it to be effective. But having said that, it'd be interesting to explore, absent of the drug, like how to enhance everything around the drug that increases that therapeutic potential. And so my current thesis project is actually going to be looking at attachment within the participants. And so obviously with people with borderline personality disorder, they're characterized by their disrupted attachment styles. And so it made me wonder whether their attachment styles might impact the therapeutic potential one might receive from the interpersonal care and attention. during these designs. And I suppose by focusing on the active placebo group and not the ketamine group, we can unravel a few interesting things around the design and maybe even offer some potential insight into how to personalize these psychedelic treatment designs for individuals with specific attachment representations. And so I haven't actually started writing my thesis yet, so it's all kind of up in the air. And I'm still kind of trying to consolidate my thoughts on it. But I think if more research goes into the therapeutic components around these psychedelic treatment designs, absent of the psychedelic drug, it will only benefit the whole procedure. It'll only improve our potential to heal these people. Because I think it's quite obvious that we can't rely just on the drug to heal the individual. You know, it's a kind of synergistic effect of therapy, insight, acting on insight induced by the drug, perhaps, and then also maybe the kind of expectation of this novel pharmaceutical drug doing what the media portrays it to do. So there's a few interesting things we can kind of take apart from the placebo group. So that kind of brings us to present day. I've yet to get the results of the actual Feinberg's ketamine results. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Definitely. Wow. There's so many interesting things that you just mentioned about your work and how your education right now at UCL and at Yale have influenced or created some type of impression on what you'd like to see in future clinical trials. I'd also like to hear maybe a bit more about how your academic journey through undergrad studying psychology may or may not have influenced how strongly you feel towards integrating developmental neuroscience and psychopathology through the lens of clinical care outside of psychedelics, or integrating new ways to measure qualitative experiences. And I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, I think I'm very passionate about integrating all these perspectives. Because I believe by doing so, you can delineate the downfalls of each one. You know, the downfalls of one will be addressed with another. And obviously, I use psychedelic therapy just because it's such a pressing example of integrating so many perspectives from the mechanistic to the interpersonal. And by no means is it limited to psychedelic therapy. I think, I guess going back, I'm sure my dad probably has a big influence on my passion for this. And he's someone who, he's a practicing hypnotherapist. And we've often had kind of discussions about, the value of spiritual approaches and the connection between spiritual practice and healing, and how science is, you know, like the aim of science is to better humanity, right? At least you'd hope it for that to be the case. And so it's always been an interest of mine as to whether there's room for science to accommodate for spiritual approaches. Mm-hmm. And this is almost like, I'm sure 50 years ago, if you heard an academic talking about integrating spiritual approaches into science, you'd probably get cancelled. And it still kind of carries that stigma nowadays. Some people just switch off if you even use the word spiritual.
Yeah, that did happen in the 60s, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. So, which makes me think, there must be another way around it, where maybe we need to reconceptualize terminology. And with spiritual approaches, there's really no need to explain these experiences by resorting to the supernatural. And two good examples are our connection with people and our connection with nature. Science already tells us we are social beings. We completely depend on one another. And when we cease to live in the mind of another, well, we suffer detrimentally, whether that's through the manifestation of loneliness or falling victim to addiction. And as for our connection with nature, we are completely interconnected with nature. We're no different from any other species. It's just our egos intend to build walls and reject connection that kind of prevents us from seeing the interconnectedness of that. And so you can almost conceptualize the opposite of spirituality as egotistical. And all spiritual practices do is try to move us away from this egotistical ruminating mind that we have developed over recent years in evolution. So all these practices do, they try to move us away from this in order to alleviate our suffering and to achieve a state of well-being, whether that's through the practice of gratitude, following, doing meditation, for example, even adhering to healthy food and exercise routines. I actually read somewhere that Canada can now prescribe people with who are suffering with depression a national park pass. Mm-hmm. And so that is like a discrete example of acknowledging the interconnectedness between us and nature and the therapeutic effect going in from an urban environment to a natural environment has on our brain. It's almost like a reset. And these are very holistic experiences which we lose the meaning of when we go down a reductionist approach to trying to understand them. Same goes for interpersonal connection. It's like there's so much going on the experiential level with interpersonal connection. And, you know, especially you see it in religious and spiritual practices where people come together and they heal through whatever, you know, whatever rituals or practices are in place. And it's very difficult to take a reductionist approach to that and, you know, explain that neurobiologically, because there's so many variables in place that are coming together to create that experience. And that experience will never always be the same. And so by the time you break that experience down into its components, you return back to the experience and one variable is changed. And then the whole thing has changed. And then your kind of the components which make up that experience invalid because that experience has suddenly changed. And it's the inherent chaos that comes with the order that is in our world. And it's like, in order to order our world, science is doing a great job, but it just fails to acknowledge the reality that we do also live in a chaotic world where patterns don't necessarily repeat. And so to me, it just makes perfect sense to try and integrate these approaches, whether you want to call it spiritual approaches or experiential approaches, and integrate them with the science and the reductionist approaches. Because it's just two sides of the same coin. And I think now we've got to such an intellectual level that we don't need to resist that integration. You know, in the 70s and 80s, you had all these disciplines which were very in their own lane and competitive, and my discipline was better than your discipline. My one's the gets you closer to the truth than your one. But in reality, they're all trying to explain the same things, but just from slightly different angles. And so it makes sense as time progresses that the boundaries between these disciplines begin to dissolve in order to help us get closer to what the hell we're trying to understand in the first place.
Totally. Do you think that your interest in avoiding a reductionist investigation, maybe of the human condition, drove you or steered you towards this program with UCL and Yale? I'd like to hear more about like how you made the decision to get your master's of research there in developmental neuro and psychopathology, because like you said, two ends of the same coin, these like stark dichotomies and approaches to the same question. But the more you focus on the model, the more inconsistent you get on the experience, right? One variable changes and all of a sudden it's no longer representational of what you're trying to study. And I feel it's a blessing and a curse. It's every statistician's worst nightmare and every philosopher's favorite dream. But like, how can we approach that through science? Like you said, if the focus for science should be empowering or generating more wellness for humans and collectivism, like how did your interest in human condition maybe influence your decision of where you wanted to investigate these interests, especially in your master's program?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, most people going into my course are hoping to either do research with children or be child therapists. Mm. And so that was initially a slight concern of mine going into it, because that wasn't a population I felt I would be good at dealing with. I almost have a degree of awkwardness if I'm to deal with it. I feel like, yeah. But the reason why I still applied for the course was because I think it's so imperative to start with the foundations, and I don't understand how anyone who's in the clinical field can disregard the developmental process. I mean, if we're speaking strictly just on the developmental perspective within the course, I was motivated by that because I thought it would really give me a solid foundation of knowledge to understand how an adult becomes an adult, you know, and how, and also just to be able to understand why, you know, I think something like 70% of all mental health problems will emerge during adolescence. And that is inherently a developmental question to address. And I almost felt like if I didn't start with, you know, understand the development of children into adolescence and then into adulthood, and went straight into maybe a clinical degree that is focusing on an adult population, I almost feel like I'd be skipping halfway through a book almost. And so that was kind of my motivation behind the developmental side of things. And then the integration of perspectives was really enticing to me because I just didn't know what perspective I was most drawn to. I was really interested in psychoanalysis, and that was something that, you know, I would read in my spare time. I was a big fan of some of Freud's work, and especially Carl Jung. And so going to it, I knew psychoanalysis was something I wanted to study, but I also knew a lot of people had reservations against psychoanalysis. And I mean, you can kind of, I think it's similar things probably happening in the US, but in the UK, there's a real concern for psychoanalysis being swept under the carpet because of the lack of, well, for a number of reasons. One being, it's difficult to provide empirical evidence for an open-end therapy when compared to a kind of manualized short-term therapy like CBT. And so when CBT emerged, it was had such a great, like a massive impact on the healthcare system for, you know, cost-effective reasons, for time-effective reasons, and also for training. It's a lot easier to train a CBT therapist than it is train a psychoanalyst. And so for all these kind of reasons, which in my eyes haven't got human mental suffering at the forefront, but instead they have other socio-political reasons that are motivating the kind of the lack of incentive in funding psychoanalysis. And so I really was thinking, right, the only way to bring psychoanalysis back into the field and back into kind of this respective framework is to start accommodating what people believe is lacking within it, which is objectivity, empirical evidence. And that's one thing that, as I briefly mentioned before with Peter Fonagy, that this is what he's been doing. And this is, I think, one of his one of his passions within his career is to reconceptualize psychoanalysis so that it still puts emphasis into experience without being regarded as a soft science. And so that's where you bring in the neurobiology of attachment, and you can start to, you know, maybe even incorporate neuroimaging to demonstrate the neurological changes that occur due to psychoanalysis, due to therapy. And there's all now these different ways we can maybe integrate the perspectives in order to bring the respect back into psychoanalysis, essentially. I also think a lot of people have issues with the terminology used in psychoanalysis. There's a lot of terminology which might be considered outdated, purely due to the time it emerged. And so maybe going forward, we do need to just reconceptualize, reword all these themes that psychoanalysis was trying to explain, you know, without taking away the meaning behind what psychoanalysis is trying to capture, but instead just using terminology which is more academically tolerable and less abstract. True. And I think this is what's currently going on at the moment. Especially, I mean, you have like psychoanalysis isn't really, we don't really like use psychoanalysis nowadays. It's kind of psychodynamic as the new terminology, which seems to be slightly more academically respected. And psychodynamic is essentially just a contemporary form of psychoanalysis, which appreciates that our psyche is dynamic and we have this experience which is regulated by both conscious and unconscious material. And I've lost my train of thought and I don't know where I was going with that, but
well, maybe I can help you find your way again. So it sounds like you knew you were interested in psychedelics or joining the psychedelic space before you joined this master's program, right?
Yeah.
So I think my follow-up to that and maybe a guide back into your train of thought, which was taking a beautiful journey, is do you find that through your coursework, through your your experiences with your mentors, with the research that you're doing right now at the last leg of your master's program, do you think that has like strongly informed your stance or the beliefs that you might have about what you'd like to see in the field?
Like incredibly so. Like the past year has completely, like I was on this kind of this path, and sure, I was interested in, you know, psychedelics for healing and all of that before this course, but something clicked when I started this course and I just became in love with the course and just the mission behind the course is just incredible. And it's such a, it's been such an incredible learning experience for me that's really helped consolidate everything I've felt, but not being able to like intellectualize. And so, one example is our course puts a lot of emphasis into systemics. So systemic therapy is a really wonderful, wonderful approach that basically takes into account that we are part of a system, you know, a system which is greater than ourselves. And here we're kind of touching on things that are associated with spiritual approaches in the sense of, like, I would say systemic therapy acknowledges that, you know, our mental suffering is not, the what's driving our mental suffering isn't focus purely on the individual. And we are, you know, part of a wider system, whether that's a family system, whether that's a political system, whether that's a nation, whether that's a culture, whether that's a religion. These are systems, interpersonal systems, which can generate and exacerbate mental health problems while also relieving mental suffering and curing, increasing well-being. And so our course puts a lot of emphasis into systemic therapy. And I guess I and also one thing I've kind of been thinking about recently, which has my course has really helped me in this kind of line of thought, is the idea that about questioning where the therapy starts and stops. You know, so you have a patient who has a problem, and currently the idea is that therapy is limited to a therapist's room, or it's limited to a pharmaceutical drug. And so if we take talk therapy as an example, you know, you might have a problem, you might fit the diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder. So you tick 5 out of 9 boxes. So you now are diagnosed with this disorder and you're receiving talk therapy. And the most common way we distinguish treatment effectiveness is through remission. And so remission is referring to the patient no longer fitting the diagnostic criteria. So maybe you do a diagnostic assessment and suddenly they only tick 3 or 4 of the 9 boxes. So they're under that 5 box threshold. And all of a sudden, that treatment's effective at treating their diagnostic disorder. And so they might then terminate their treatment and go on with their daily lives. But then you got to ask the question of, have they truly recovered? And so there's a distinction between remission and recovery. And what recovery implies is you need to achieve remission, but you also need to have at least one meaningful relationship that's significant to your life. And you also need to be enrolled in some form of work or education to provide yourself with a sense of meaning and purpose. And so with all of this emphasis focused around remission as opposed to recovery, I think we're limiting the healing potential, because, you know, while it's great to see that people's symptoms are reducing and, you know, they're not necessarily fitting this rigid diagnostic box, it doesn't mean to say that the therapy has provided them with a meaningful and happy life, because I don't know how meaningful one's life can be if they fail to form one meaningful relationship and also fail to work or be in some form of education. And so maybe we need to broaden our horizon as to where therapy starts and stops. And so this doesn't need to be limited to psychedelic therapy, although it would be really effective with psychedelic therapy. But if we're just talking about psychotherapy more generally, it would be interesting to provide patients with like support after therapy in order to ensure that everything that the insight they've gained during therapy is successfully integrated. And so maybe your main problem is you're feeling very down and you suffer with some form of low mood. And on top of that, like on the kind of periphery of that, you don't really have any social circle. You feel relatively disconnected from people. Now, talk therapy might help in improving your mood might help with altering your cognition, giving you tools to cope with that that difficult environment that you live in. But then what if we offer them social workers to continue that therapy after the therapy finishes? So, you know, maybe someone is really struggling to integrate into their community. So, you know, you've managed as a therapist, you've managed to help them no longer fit the diagnostic criteria. And so maybe they're about to come to the end of their treatment. And then you pair them up with a team of social workers to continue that healing work outside of therapy. So maybe integrating them into a book club. Maybe they love reading, but they don't have the kind of the confidence to reach out and go to these groups. So maybe you have a social worker to take you there every month, and to maybe check up on you every couple of weeks for maybe a few months after the termination of treatment to really ensure that the integration is implemented. Because at the moment, I feel like there's too many people will go to therapy to resolve their problems and then leave that therapy into their maladaptive, their undesirable environments, and have all of those problems just exacerbate and reactivate. And so you have this relapse, this kind of vicious cycle of relapse. And one benefit this would also provide is, obviously, nowadays to be a therapist, it's no easy job, and it requires a lot of money and time. And so, sure, if you have a lot of money, it's very easy to enroll in university. You can pay your way through a very good university and you can get all the qualifications, the training, and that's all great. But if you, you know, come from a less well-off background, maybe don't have the opportunities or the time to pursue a lengthy doctorate that requires a lot of investment. But if those people still have this burning desire to help people, maybe having this kind of infrastructure in place with social workers to be a part of the like therapeutic process will open up a whole load of jobs for these people who really want to help people, really want to heal people, but haven't got the money or the time or the opportunity to pursue, you know, this academic commitment. And this is particularly relevant with psychedelic therapy, I think, because I think there's so many great healers who are in this field who will be doing this work in an unregulated manner. And they might be incredible at what they're doing. But as psychedelic therapy is becoming more popular, we need to be very careful with, you know, regulating therapy and having appropriate training in place, because we don't want unlawful practice, which might have been the case in the 60s. And so on one hand, we want to have a, you know, solid procedures around training, the facilitation of these psychedelic therapists. But on the other hand, we don't want to make it more difficult for those who have less, you know, opportunity, whether it's time or money, to do all the adequate training and jump through all those all those hoops in order to get the certificate, like the kind of legislation in place in order to be licensed to do this healing work. And so broadening our scope of where therapy starts and stops, we can get more and more people involved in this kind of healing process without them being prevented by the money incentives and the costly time the commitment might have. And so that's something I guess my course has helped me to think about, because this, like, systemic therapy is almost, you know, you're reaching beyond the individual and the stereotypical kind of patient therapist dynamic, and you're acknowledging that, you know, their family system might be contributing to their problem. Are they just going to go back into, are they just going to relapse every time they go back to their home environment? maybe we bring their home environment into the equation. So that's one big factor that my course has really helped me to start considering. And I think I wouldn't be surprised in the next 5-10 years, we're going to see more systemic approaches and more, implementation around the actual therapy sessions to contribute to the therapeutic process.
Has there been a specific systemic therapeutic modality or a mentor in this space that has really influenced your stance on this case of integrating systemic treatments for long-term or continued support through psychological well-being and care?
There's not one that comes to mind. I've brushed through quite a few different names. There isn't one off the top of my head that I could provide right now. There is one form of therapy which seems to be gaining quite a lot of popularity at the moment, which is called internal family systems. And that do you know the man behind that? He's a family therapist, and this internal family systems therapy was directly influenced from his kind of systemic way of thinking and the kind of the role systems play and how we kind of need to move away from this illusion that the individual is all there is. And, we are such a product of our environments and the connection we have with other people that it's too simplified to assume that the individual is all and we can solve mental health. We can solve mental suffering by dealing strictly with the individual. And here we're starting to see, we're kind of returning back to these themes of the reductionist approach you have with science, and then the more open-ended and experiential approach that spirituality is so concerned with. Because on one hand, sure, you take a reductionist approach to deal with an individual in therapy, and that has its value. You can draw from CBT to delineate the components based on their cognitive processes, and that's all fine. But then you also need to acknowledge the system in which that suffering is situated within. Mm-hmm. And they're not disconnected in any way. And here, this is just an example of where if we took a purely reductionist approach, we would fail to see that interconnectedness that individual suffering has within their system. And so you might never really fully resolve the problem, because you're just sending the individual back out into that environment, which would then just produce that problem in the first place. So you really need to take a top down and bottom up approach to all of this. I really couldn't stress that enough.
I think it's really interesting that you brought up IFS, because as you were talking about delineating or avoiding pathologizing modalities of treatment, especially psychedelic or not, just, holding the general wellness for the people you're treating as the center focus of your approach to healing, not as much trying to bag them into a diagnosis and treat them according to their diagnosis rather than more holistically. I feel like that was also really similar in IFS in general, because it's non-pathologizing, which kind of goes right back into what you were saying as well. The guy's name is Richard Schwartz.
Yeah.
That's it, right? Yeah. But I just felt like that fit in so well with everything you were contextualizing with systems and how they exist outside of the person. But for internal family systems, it's the parts of yourself and how they relate inside. And it's those same systems being parts of your identity that might be in conflict, and bringing them into the same room when you're trying to work on healing the person, bringing in their family, bringing in what their home environment might be like. And those are all extremely poignant parts of how they might acclimate to their life after getting treatment, especially in one of these clinical trials where, there's so much attention to measuring objectively or quantitatively how their symptom relief from whatever diagnosis that they had coming into the study. but it's also, as you said, so important for the continued support after they leave the clinical trial, after they receive the active placebo or the newly tested therapeutic drug for their disease. What I'm wondering next is, based on the research experience that you've had here at Yale, what do you think is next for you in terms of clinical trial research or psychedelic therapy? Where would you like to see yourself after graduation?
Yeah, I want to get a clinical doctorate. But in between that, I think I'm going to take a year out and travel a bit to around Central America and South America to expose myself to the more naturalistic side of healing people with, you know, plant medicine and maybe working with ayahuasca and mescaline, peyote, and also psilocybin mushrooms. And I really want to spend at least a year in those environments to try to get a better understanding behind the therapeutic components underlying what the work they're doing, you know, and then seeing whether there's a place for science to accommodate for that. And so before pursuing a kind of a doctorate, I'd think it'd be very useful to gain some experience on the more naturalistic and holistic side of healing people, and then go back into that kind of reductionist way of thinking and take that and then reduce it down into the components and then hopefully create my own kind of therapeutic paradigm, which incorporates all of the things we've kind of been discussing, you know, around systemic therapy, the mechanistic action of these drugs and why on the mechanistic side of things, they're doing the work they're doing. And then also having those like the social work being a kind of a integral part of the integration, so that when you say goodbye to your patients, that's not the end of their healing. And, you know, you're passing them on to the kind of the end stage of the healing process, which will be social workers. And I would love to be able to bring all of that together into some kind of therapeutic package. But obviously that, I mean, that's not going to happen anytime soon. And I think maybe for the next 10, 15 years, it's just a matter of trying to learn as much as I can, just to experience as many different approaches and perspectives to healing people as possible, in order to really figure out what seems to work and what doesn't, and what resonates the most with me. So yes, I'm going to take a year out, do some traveling and try and explore a bit more in the kind of plant medicine communities, and then return back to the academic world and pursue a clinical doctorate while still keeping a foot in the door of research, because obviously all of this is all such novel, but we'll see.
Let's say someone right now is listening and has found so much alignment and validation through your explanation and your experience so far in the field, but they're interested in studying and focus in doing research on the same things as you. What advice or recommendations might you have for them as they continue on to their journey?
Talk to as many people as possible. Like, I went through a period, and I'm still in that period, where I have no shame in emailing people who, you know, like professors and researchers. I'm that annoying guy that will just reach out to anyone I can who I think I could learn from or could provide me with some sort of opportunities, and I'll just try and connect with them. And I think building connections, I feel like it's almost one of the most valuable things. You know, just try connect with as many like-minded people, and make an effort to be the dumbest one in the room, because then you'll learn the fastest. Don't be ashamed to be the dumbest one in the room, because in the moment it might be uncomfortable, but you will find that you excel very quickly. So don't be afraid to reach out to people who you think you could develop from or learn from or gain some opportunities from, and put yourself in uncomfortable positions where you are the dumbest person in the room. They're probably the two things that have really helped me.
And if anyone's listening and hears what you just said as your recommendation being just reach out, are you someone that they could also reach out to?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love for anyone to reach out to me who resonated with anything I said.
How should they do that?
Email is maybe the best way. So you can reach out to me, max.c.woody with a Y at the end @gmail.com.
And I'll type that out in the description.
Thank you for having me. And I hope some of what I said made sense.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the podcast as much as I enjoyed making it. I'm going to put links in the description from Max's conversation, including his master's program and a bit more about its history. So be sure to check that out if you're interested. Thank you all for listening. If you liked our podcast and would like to connect with like-minded spirits, jump over to the Psychedelic Grad community. If you're looking for psychedelic studies, field announcements, and job openings, you can sign up for the Psychedelic Grad newsletter with the link in the description. If you liked what you heard on today's podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. I hope to see you back here for our next episode.